Okay, I guess it's 7 o'clock, time to call the Board of Adjustment. 6 o'clock.
You're an hour ahead.
I'm always an hour ahead.
Adjourn.
Yeah, call the meeting to order. I think the first thing on the agenda is to adopt the agenda. So, we're going to read the minutes. We're going to adopt the minutes of January 26th. 2021, which was our last meeting. Didn't have any old business, new business. We elected chair and vice chair. And we did the annual report, an oath of office for Kurt Bartley as a full member.
That's for tonight.
Oh, that's for tonight.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Have to make a motion to adopt the agenda.
Let's adopt the agenda.
Yeah. Second.
We've changed our agenda since last time you did it.
Okay. All right.
Second.
Okay.
Then you want to entertain a motion to adopt the minutes.
Then let's adopt the minutes of the last meeting.
Second.
Okay.
Do we do seconds in both?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. All right. So minutes have been accepted.
Well, you need
accepted.
To vote.
All in favor.
We need to vote.
All in favor.
It's been a year since I
That's why we're here.
Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Everything passes. Everything goes. Okay. Do we have any old business?
No.
All right. New business. We need to elect a chairman and a vice chairman. Do I have any?
Let Harry Humphries be chairman.
My second. All in favor?
Aye. Majority controls.
All right. Vice chair, Kurt Bartley.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
That's all right. You got to be here every meeting.
I don't have to be here.
Sometimes.
I have. Okay. The 2001 annual report. 2021 annual report. We had a meeting January 26th, 2021. And that's all we did. I mean, it was a tough year.
It was.
So.
I see a motion to approve it.
Motion to approve the annual report.
Second.
Okay. Next on the list is
all in favor.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Oath of office for Kurt Bartley as a full member.
All right, you ready?
Kurt.
So, Kurt,
make
you get
your copy.
You get to be sweared at.
We don't have our bottle.
Oh. I'm gonna grab it.
I mean, we could use my phone, but.
It's got one on there, I'm sure.
I'm sure they're
doing.
You can always get it.
Download one real quick.
Yeah.
I have a couple on here.
All right.
I need to stay in.
Please, sir. I, Kurt Bartley, swear that I will support and maintain the Constitution and laws.
I, Kurt Bartley, swear that I will support the Constitution and the laws.
Of the United States.
Of the United States.
And the Constitution and laws of the State of North Carolina.
And the Constitution and laws of the State of North Carolina.
Not inconsistent therewith.
Not inconsistent therewith.
And that I will faithfully discharge my duties as a full member of the Board of Adjustment.
That I will faithfully discharge my duty as a full member of the Board of Adjustments.
For the town of Curry Beach, so help me God.
For the town of Curry Beach, so help me God.
Yeah. Very good. You're now official. All right, the next on the agenda is the recommendation to town council for two alternate vacancies. Do we have to do anything about Connie?
You'll do it, I guess, once council actually accepts the resignation, then you will. They do it first, okay. So.
Do we have anybody?
Connie had to resign. Yeah. No, we don't have any alternates. So we need.
I thought we had some applicants.
Yeah, we don't have any currently. You have two that are interested in serving on the...
It's a five-person board without alternates, is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we've got how many vacancies?
Two.
Two.
Well, technically three, but one hasn't been officially resigned because Connie's technically not until town council.
Is one of the three in here?
Mm-hmm.
We got a five-person board, you got three vacancies, I see three people.
Well, the
well, you have.
Connie's resigned.
Connie's resigned, and
we had a vacancy.
Mm-hmm.
So now, You still have a quorum. We still got three.
No, I'm just wondering where the third vacancy is. If we got three and Connie and vacancy.
Connie and two alternates.
Yeah. We have Connie
they're
and two
They're referring
alternates.
To the alternates.
We have to fill two
right,
alternates.
Let me start again, because I never can remember between all the commissions and the boards. Does the BOA have alternate members?
Mm-hmm. Yes, two.
It's a five-person board, two alternate members. Mm-hmm. The alternates are vacant. And Connie's going to resign.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Correct.
Got it.
But who's missing then?
Randy.
Randy.
Neely.
Because he's gone.
But he's also a full-time member too now, right? Mm-hmm.
And again, for my edification, have we advertised those positions?
The two we have. I have not advertised for Connie's, which will be obviously a full member.
And the two that you have advertised for, did we get applicants?
We got two.
And so I'm just curious, what happens? We bring this to council next meeting?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. This board doesn't interview like PNC does. Town council makes the decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
That's according to the rules of procedure.
Okay. So we have 5.5?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Now it's training with the Attorney Aldridge.
I'll take that, Chairman. Thank you. If you can turn to the first, the header is the same on all of them, but if you can turn to the first page like that. The training materials and comments. A couple of introductory remarks. One, I copied these out of the code, and I was in a big hurry, so the formatting isn't as what it should be, but it's good enough for us to get through it. Number two, the reason for the training is, previously this board was governed by Chapter 160A of the General Statutes. And Chapter 160A is a multitude of things, including planning and development, administration, boundaries, you name it. With respect to a city, 168 covered it. But with respect to planning and development, that coverage was sporadic, inconsistent, and scattered. So a couple of years ago, the General Assembly passed a new chapter, 160D. And 160D took all of the planning and development provisions of 168, recombined them, modified them, organized them, tweaked them, and put them into 160D. So your existence and your function and your authority is now covered by 160D, not 160A. 160D significantly changed the scope of, enlarged the scope of your duties and responsibilities, clarified some things that we'll spend a little bit of time on, and increased the risk that you, and you don't put too much stock in this language, but increased the risk this body in this town faces in exercising its lawful functions, duties, and responsibilities. And that namely is a very broad provision for a private litigant to get attorney's fees if we're sued as a result of a planning and development regulation decision and they win. And it ain't vice versa. We don't get attorney's fees, but they do. As a matter of fact, the statute's so broad, they get it in three different ways, and it's always shall and not may. So, since you took an oath, you're bound.
I just bring back the police, shall and may.
Yes.
So we're going to walk through some of those things pretty quickly, and it's going to be informal. I'll just point out some things, give you my remarks about them, and if you have questions or remarks, we'll discuss them. The other thing I wanted to, so we're not going to focus on quasi-judicial so much. We'll touch on it, but you all are, you haven't had any experience with this board? But I know you two have. Have you been around for a quasi-judicial?
Oh, yeah. I've been in government work for 30-plus years.
So when I say quasi-judicial, you know what I mean. Okay. We're not going to focus too much on that, but I did want to mention, if you want to, if you don't have anything better to do and you want some entertainment, next week, the Historic Preservation Commission, Wednesday at 6 o'clock, we're going to do a mock COA, Certificate of Appropriateness hearing. And that's going to be the third element of their quasi-judicial training. They've never done anything quasi-judicial, and they're going to get some curveballs. These two ladies, I hope, will participate with those curveballs. And should be really entertaining. And you can see, with your experience with quasi-judicial, you can see how they're going to wrestle with certain things. Although their test is very simple. Their test is whether the proposed changes to any exterior features in the historic district are consistent and compatible with the look and feel of that neighborhood. That's the only thing they have to figure out. But it's an evidentiary hearing, and the applicant has to carry his burden. And it does affect you all in a way that we'll see pretty soon. Well, there's the alternate members right there. Anyway, we can turn, that's Wednesday at 6 o'clock. If we can turn our attention to, my pages are numbered, page 1 of the training material. I basically just copied the whole section. There isn't much here that I want to tell you about. Composition, terms, removal, filling of vacancies, organization, meetings, quorum, you all are familiar with that. What I really wanted to start focusing on page 8 of 18 and page 2 of me, is powers and duties. And I did not highlight everything throughout that I wanted to discuss, but I did here. Heretofore, BOA has been charged with variances, certainly. But also appeals of determinations, interpretations, and decisions made with respect to zoning. Now, your scope of authority has been enlarged to variances and appeals, but not just of zoning, administrative decisions. And we're going to see in a minute how 160, well, as a matter of fact, let's go ahead and look for that. Let me make sure I've got it someplace. I'm not sure you were copying it.
Looking for the appeal.
I'm looking for, hang on just a minute. Beth, can you get chapter 15's definitions on your, and can we put it up on the screen? Is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I thought I had copied administrative decisions into my little training materials.
Which section did you
15
want?
15 definitions. It'll be in the A's, which should be right up on the screen. No, I'm sorry, chapter 12 definitions.
Can you go to? Where are those under Jim? Do you remember? Oh, they're there.
Administrative decisions. So you've gone from being responsible for appeals of zoning decisions to now being responsible for decisions made in the implementation, administration, or enforcement of development regulations. The rest of it means quasi-judicial. If you go down to development regulations, please.
In where, Jim?
Just, I don't know whether to scroll up or scroll down, right there.
Oh.
A development regulation, again, where you used to be responsible just for zoning, now you're responsible for code provisions, including zoning, subdivision, erosion and sedimentation, which I don't think we've got anything for that. floodplain or flood damage, although that's John Batson's jurisdiction, you're responsible for hearing appeals under that provision. Mountain Ridge, we don't have too many mountains, so we don't have to worry about that. Stormwater control, that's a public works and a town council topic, but if somebody's denied a permit or a transfer, it's going to come to you. Wireless telecommunication facility regulations, I guess we got those, we got two towers. Historic preservation, and we'll talk more about what comes to you from there in a minute. Housing code, state building code. Housing code, I think, would include minimum housing regulations, although it has built into that section of the code its own appeal provisions or any other regulation pursuant to this chapter. All we've got to focus on is zoning, subdivision, floodplain, stormwater, wireless telecommunication facility, but that's more a question of location more than anything else. I don't think you'll ever see anything like that. Historic preservation, you could very well get that, and housing code. So that's quite a step up from what you've been used to, just zoning. And again, it's the same idea. If you go back to page 2, you'll see the top highlight under four is the expansion of your scope of authority. But I then want to draw your attention to the bold 1508-120. This is Historic Preservation Commission. They're responsible for deciding, approving or denying certificates of appropriateness for changes on any exterior feature within the Downtown Preservation District, which is essentially B1. If you ever have an opportunity, you can go to the website and pull down the design standards for the Preservation District. I think it's under local certificate of acceptance. Mm-hmm. You go to local certificate of acceptance, you'll see the design standards. I don't know if the all of the zoning regulations are in there, but the zoning regulations pursuant to the Downtown Preservation District are set forth in 1508-120. I didn't include them here. What I did include was section P from there that says to the extent you're going to be responsible for, if an applicant comes in for a COA, and he's denied that COA, or if an applicant comes in for a COA and is granted that COA, but there is an opponent that has standing to challenge that procedure, then either one of those parties can appeal that decision to you. But you have to handle it in the way that 160D 1402 tells you to handle it, and that is in the nature of certiorari. Now, nature, when you're hearing, heretofore, when you've heard an appeal or a variance, you've taken the evidence, you've applied the standards, you've made a decision. Nature, but I don't believe you've ever done anything in the nature of certiorari. The nature of certiorari is basically best exemplified by an appeals court. If I have a trial in the local district or superior court, then I'm going to take that appeal to the Court of Appeals. And they do it in the nature of certiorari, which basically means no new evidence comes in, no new testimony comes in. The deciding, the body handling the appeal in the nature of certiorari simply looks at the record from the actions below, entertains the arguments put forth by the applicant and the opponents or their counsel, and makes a decision based on that material. So it's a little bit different than what you've done before. What you've done before is take exhibits, take testimony, summarize those things, make findings, identify the evidence that supports those findings. But in the nature of certiorari, which is basically only going to be, as far as I can remember, is basically only going to be COA decisions appealed to you all in light of the statute and the code. In those instances, you're going to be making your decision based on the record. You're not going to take any testimony. You're not going to take any exhibits. I think if it ever gets to that point, you'll be dealing with attorneys presenting arguments, citing authorities and cases and things like that. And you'll still have to make a decision. But I did copy 1402 just so you could get a feeling for what nature of certiorari is like. And I'll give you a couple of good examples. I've done a lot of litigation, civil litigation, so if you are rear-ended and you can't settle with the insurance company and you tell me to sue the other driver, I'm going to file a complaint and I'm going to have a summons issued. And you're going to be served with that. They call that process. You're going to be served with that process. And you're going to answer, and then we'll go through the whole dance, motions, discovery, depositions, mediation, trial. On the other hand, if I've been in front of BOA on the appeal and I get shot down and I lose my appeal, and the general statutes tell us, and the code also now provides for, that BOA decision that I didn't like is subject to judicial review. So I can take it to court. But I'm not going to file a complaint, and I'm not going to have a summons issued. What I am going to do, it's just a paper chase, and I'm sure it's something that is anachronistic in the sense that it's been around a long time and nobody ever changed it. What I'm going to file is a writ of certiorari, which is basically asking the Superior Court to review my situation. And what happens is an order, the clerk, I mean, it's a paper chase, really. There's no, I'll get it, regardless. What the clerk will do is sign an order of certiorari, and that simply means that my case has been accepted for judicial review, and it always will be accepted, but that's the drill. Two things happen after that, unlike civil litigation where we're getting into motions and we're getting into discovery and depositions and mediation and trial. Nature of certiorari, two things happen. One, we submit a record to the court, and there's always another attorney involved, so the attorney and I will call, you know, it might be Wilmington, I've had one with Wilmington. And I hit a Grand Slam home run, by the way. It's one of my best victories. That attorney and I will agree on a date that we show. They'll usually put together the record. They'll submit it to me. I like it. I'll amend it. I'll tweak it. I reject certain parts. We agree. And we file that record by an agreed upon deadline. And nothing else happens until the hearing. And at the hearing, we'll come in with our written briefs and our arguments, just like in the Supreme Court. And we'll present arguments in support of our respective positions, and the court will make a decision and put down a judgment. So that's what certiorari is like. So you would, in a COA situation, you'd be accepting the record, you'd be reviewing the record. And the record will consist of the COA application, a transcript of the COA hearing, and any exhibits and testimony, the testimony being the transcript, and any exhibits entered as part of the record, which would include, for example, a summary by staff and whatever the applicant and whatever the opponent that has standing. That's a very crucial qualification for people that oppose it. It's not a public hearing. You don't get up and make comments. The only parties to a quasi-judicial hearing are, of course, the applicant and somebody who is opposed to the proposal that will suffer special damages. And it took me years to understand what special damages are compared to compensatory damages for pain and suffering, property damages for, you know, injury to property, consequential damages under a contract,
special damages are when you, because of your unique situation to the proposed project, will suffer damages that nobody else will suffer because of that same project.
And who determines whether or not a person has standing?
Well, we're going to get to that. But a good example of special damages is if you can prove that campground that's here for a special use permit is going to result in diminished property values for yourself, that's special damages. If you can prove that the increased traffic from that proposed use presents a safety and risk issue, that's special damages. And determining standing, and that's a great question because, number one, in a typical quasi-judicial hearing, that's a difficult thing for a lay board to figure out because of what I just said. It's also difficult because usually the way you would prove special damages is through an expert witness. And you all have ample experience, I'm sure, with public hearings and probably quasi-judicial hearings. The public doesn't know that. The opponents don't know that. They'll get up and bitch all day about traffic. They'll get up and say it's going to hurt my property. But they never hire an appraiser. Well, I've been, after 30 years, it's been never in my multiple instances. They never hire an appraiser. They don't hire a traffic engineer. And by statute, you cannot, a lay opinion, i.e. a non-expert witness opinion, on reduced property value or traffic and safety issues is incompetent. That's the first point I would say in relation to your question. The second point I would say in relation to your question is how is that handled? Well, let's take a couple of examples because it's the same in either case, but it impacts how you would process that issue sitting as the decision maker in a quasi-judicial proceeding or sitting as a reviewing decision-making board in the nature of certiorari, because then the issue of standing is really dealt with by that commission below you. Mm-hmm. And you know, good luck to them, because it's hard. Because here's what happens. The context is quasi-judicial hearing. Applicant makes their case. Chairman announces anybody with standing that is in opposition to this project come forward and be heard. So somebody gets up, doesn't have any experts, and starts to moan and groan about property values and traffic issues. It's for the chairman of that lay board is really not it, and the board itself, and to a certain extent you all, are simply not equipped with the knowledge you need on a fairly sophisticated and somewhat complex legal issue to make those determinations like a judge would. So a couple things tend to happen. Remembering that the chairperson always has control over the hearing. So let's assume that somebody gets up and complains about traffic and property values and they've got no experts, they've got no exhibits, they've got no proof. Depending on the personality that's chairing that hearing, if it was me, I would ask a few pertinent questions about special damages. Do you have any experts? Do you have any proof? And if the answers were in the negative all along, I would be bold and assertive enough to say, it's my determination, I think the chairman can do this and not necessarily have to have the commission vote on it. It's my determination you don't have standing and I will ask you to sit down, whatever the language is. On the other hand, sometimes those opponents are allowed to speak because the thinking on the board side is, well, I don't really want to shut this down. I don't want to really seem like a bully. This is a red button issue. If it's, we'll let the courts sort it out. So sometimes they err on the side of safety and let that person speak.
Well, we have done that in the past in some of our cases.
And there's two things that you have to be careful, well, three things that you have to be careful about right there. And they're all, the first two are intangible. Well, the first one's intangible. You have to kind of worry about, I would be concerned about setting a precedent. But I do think it's practical and that it happens a lot to let those opponents speak. However, if that opponent is from a development and they've got 10 other people behind them that are going to say the same damn thing, after two or three of the same darn thing, the chairman's going to say, we'll be glad to hear anybody else that is opposed to this, provided they've got something new to say. I'm cutting off any further testimony or exhibits that is redundant to what we've already heard. That's one way to handle it. The other consideration you have to keep in mind is, and you just kind of have to navigate this, but if you get it wrong and you're dealing with somebody that knows what they're doing and they've got a good attorney, they're going to take it to court, and if they win, they're going to ask for attorney's fees. The last time that, a few years ago, I represent another town, and no more than two or three years ago, that town and an HOA were locked in civil litigation regarding one little paragraph in the covenant, in the Declaration of Covenants. Nothing, it wasn't an outrageous suit. It was just a typical, well-fought, thorough, comprehensive civil litigation about one paragraph in the Covenant of Declarations. Both sides spent six figures in attorney's fees, and there wasn't anything unusual about it. I was very much involved in the litigation involving Belleville, Leland, and the Sanitary District, and in 18 months, those three bodies spent $1.5 million. So litigation is expensive, and I just think you have to keep that in mind when you're dealing with the problem of somebody having standing. But let's see if there's anything further in 14 or, well, yes, look at the bottom on page 2, standing. The person may be, a petition may be, and now this is the petition, this statute concerns itself with nature of certiorari in superior court, judicial review of a quasi-judicial decision. But remember, under the, looking up to 1508.120p, you're going to hear HPC appeals in the nature of certiorari, and to the extent applicable, the provisions of the statute that we're looking at shall apply. So therefore, since standing is highlighted under the statute that applies, and you need to follow that statute to the extent that you can, since you're not the Superior Court, let's look at what standing is. Any person possessing an ownership interest in the property subject to the decision being appealed, a leasehold interest is also good, an easement interest also gives them standing, or a covenant in the declaration also gives them standing. An option or contract to purchase the property gives them standing. An applicant who's appealing has got standing. And any other person who suffers special damages. So that gets us back to what we've already discussed. Three, and to continue with who has standing, basically an HOA that meets those criteria. The local government. So the town could actually seek judicial review of the BOA's decision. The town's got standing to challenge your quasi-judicial the respondent, then we're getting into something else. Number four takes care of that. So standing is a very difficult issue. Now, under nature certiorari, you're not, you may still have the responsibility of making the determination regarding standing, but you're not going to have the same problems that the decision-making board had. And why would you not have the same problems?
You're not adding any new.
What's that?
You're not adding any new evidence, right?
Right.
You're just reviewing what's already
been
submitted.
You're not dealing with anybody getting up and talking. All you're doing is looking at the record. And so you would look at the record to see if any of those criteria are met. And if they're not, or if they say special damages but it's not supported by competent material sufficient evidence, your decision, if it's an issue in that nature certiorari appeals, they don't have standing. So when you're doing it, when you're fulfilling your reviewing function, standing is not too much of an issue because you'll just look at what happened below. On the other side of the coin, if you're in a decision-making case, purely quasi-judicial, that topic, well, I'm sure it's come up before and sounds like you all handle it by in a practical way, which is fine. Going to change gears here. There are other, that whole statute is set forth on 3 and 4 and 5. It's a big statute. 6 is also the same statute, and 7 is also the same statute. And I do see on page 8 where I did have administrative decisions and development regulations, so I feel better about myself. But those remaining sections of the statute, I would encourage you to read them because some of them have applicability to your function when you're sitting in the nature, when you're entertaining in the nature certiorari and appeal from HPC. For example, just to pick one example, go to page, well, you may look at page 4 for a minute. In the court, in the middle of that page, subsection G, the court may get motions to intervene by a party that claims they have standing that wasn't participating or maybe wasn't allowed to participate in the hearing. I think it's possible you all could get motions to for intervention. But there's also the possibility that, I don't know where it is in here, it's somewhere in the statute, but sometimes you can supplement the record based on what the statute is telling you. Let me see if I can find that real quickly. Section 160D, 1402 is a monster statute. I don't know where it is right at this moment, but somewhere in that statute is, let me show you, let me digress for a minute. Go to page 6 at the top, number 3, the term competent evidence. Jump all the way to the bottom of that paragraph. Shall not be deemed to include the opinion testimony of lay witnesses to any of the following. The A is the reduction in property values. B is the vehicular traffic resulting in safety and risk and other matters about which only an expert should be able to testify to. Like I said, somewhere in here is how you can supplement the record, and you could be faced with that. But again, that's why you have an attorney, so we won't worry about that. We've already talked about on page 8 how administrative decisions and development regulations, how those 160B changes have enlarged the scope of your duties and responsibilities. You'll also note that we basically had to rewrite 5 or 6 chapters in the town code in order to comply with 160D. And you're looking at some of those here. Chapter 12, 06, 050 lays out what everybody needs to know about quasi-judicial procedures. The notice of hearing, how you, on the top of page 9, how you handle administrative materials. Remember, you don't usually get an agenda in advance like other town bodies and commissions would, because it's paramount that you end up being impartial decision makers. That's the due process right that anybody that has standing, including the applicants, is due from us. And that's where you can really get in trouble if you violate it. So basically, heretofore, you would come in cold and get your materials. This says that you can do it that way, but if you're going to distribute those materials ahead of time, you've also got to send those same materials to the applicant. But I'd encourage you just to come in cold without any ex parte discussions amongst yourselves. You know this is basic, mm-hmm. and without doing any homework, because you just have to be impartial. Number 5, presentation of evidence. You can read that on your own. New issues are now allowed by statute and therefore code to arise in the court. You know, they might be appealing A, B, and C, but when they get up to argue, they throw D and E at you. This is allowable now under the new provisions, but of course you can also exercise a continuance so that no prejudice results by that surprise. Oaths and subpoenas. I've always thought it's a good thing that the board making quasi-judicial decisions can issue subpoenas, but I've never seen it done. I'm aware of one situation where it was requested and the chair turned it down. That's the only time I've ever seen it. Appeals in the nature of certiorari, when hearing an appeal pursuant to 947E, I have to look that up, but I think that's housing code. But we know that that's Historic Preservation Commission. And we've already talked about that. And that's a majority vote, where the only time you have a supermajority vote requirement is variances, and you know that. The part that I want to draw your attention to in finishing up my remarks starts at the bottom of page 10. There's two more statutes that I want to talk about. This one and the one that awards attorney's fees to successful private litigants. The interesting thing about this code provision, 1210.040, tracks a 160D statute, and it basically says that without, there's an exception that involves you all, but it basically says that in most other instances that the applicant doesn't have, or even the opponent, I guess, it's probably anybody, yeah, a person with standing, doesn't have to wait till the end of the process on the local government level to go to court. That litigant, or that they can file a complaint for declaratory relief, injunction relief, and other remedies, except for otherwise provided in this section for claims involving questions of interpretation, in other words, appeals of administrative decisions, or interpretations, I should say, that's limited. And in lieu of any other remedies available under the code, a person of standing may bring an original civil action, that's not nature's certiorari, that summons and complaint, the complaints for a declaratory judgment, setting forth the rights and obligations of the parties to that lawsuit, in state or federal court. Pray to God it's not federal court, because that's going to be really expensive. Seeking declaratory relief, injunctive relief, and damages. So they can bypass some of the stuff that used to be required to follow through on the local government level and go to court if one of the three requirements on the top of page 11 are met. The ordinance on its face or as applied is unconstitutional. The ordinance on its face or as applied is beyond the authority of the town as delegated to it under the general statutes. I don't think, well, thanks to me, I don't think we'll have problems with one or two, because I'm pretty careful in drafting the ordinances within the parameters of the enabling legislation. Number three, the ordinance, either on its face or as applied, constitutes a taking of property. And that could come up, but that's a hard hill to climb. Even though I think that at the end of the day, under one and two, we could survive, that does not mean that a smart attorney won't go down that road. It doesn't take much of draftsmanship to take an adverse decision in the context that we're dealing with, planning and development, and making a claim that it's unconstitutional. That's not a hard thing to do. We may win that at the end of the day, but the bottom line is you can never predict what happens in litigation. It is always, even if you're as strong as you can possibly be, it is always a roll of the dice. Always. It just means we have to do our job very carefully. I wanted to draw it again, the formatting's a little off. I think it should be a paragraph, but under subsection 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down, a little to the right of the middle, an adverse ruling from the Board of Adjustment. Let me start above. Let's just read 3. The ordinance on its face or as applied constitutes a taking of property. There should be a paragraph break there. If the decision being challenged is from an administrative official charged with enforcement of a local land development regulation, the party who is standing must first bring any claim that the ordinance was erroneously interpreted to the Board of Adjustment. So, somebody wants to put a pool on the ocean side of a Curie Beach property, or they want to put a deck on the ocean side. They come to John. John looks at all, maybe it's CAMA, maybe it's the code, or both, and he says, no, I'm sorry, our regulations will not allow that. The applicant can go to court to challenge that and seek a judicial ruling, but they first have to come to you not in the nature of certiorari, but as an appeal of an administrative decision. So that would be a quasi-judicial. But after they jump through that hoop, they're welcome to go to court and file that lawsuit. So there's a new set of risks that we didn't have before. And those risks, you can see at the bottom of the page, subsection 3, they've got a 1-year statute of limitations to do that. You can see who has standing in the middle of the page. A lot of people have standing. Then I want to draw your attention to the last statute on page 12. In any action in which a city or county is a party, and that would be the case for the statute we just looked at, where they're seeking a declaratory judgment, or in any judicial review of a quasi-judicial decision, the town's going to be a party. Upon a finding by the court that the city or county violated a statute or case law setting forth unambiguous limits on its authority, the court shall award reasonable attorney's fees. The next one, 4 lines down towards the left. In any action in which a city or county is a party, upon a finding by the court that the city or county took action inconsistent with those statutes, which I don't recall off the top of my head, the court shall award reasonable attorney's fees. Thought there was a third one, but and then the catch-all, which is not a shall, it's a may, so it's discretionary. In all other matters, the court may award attorney's fees to the prevailing private litigant. But there's no quid pro quo. The town will never be in that position. They just have to defend against the litigant seeking attorney's fees. So, I would encourage you to, in summary, 160D made some significant changes. Those significant changes impact you through enlarging the scope of your duties and responsibilities in that your appeals of administrative decisions is larger than what you've been doing before, which is basically decisions involving zoning only. Now we're dealing with subdivision, which is, they'll have to figure that one out because an appeal of a subdivision decision by statute goes to court, so I'm not sure that would ever come to you, but zoning, subdivision in theory, stormwater management, building permits, these will all now be part of your scope of authority. Point two, Historic Preservation Commission for sure is part of your authority, and you may someday get that. In most cases, your quasi-judicial function remains the same as to what you're used to. In the case of an appeal of a certificate of appropriateness decision, your quasi-judicial function is completely different. You'll be reviewing it in nature certiorari, looking at the record only. We've talked a little bit about standing, and that's not the first time that we've talked about it. We've talked about competent evidence, and that lay opinions on special damage elements is incompetent. We've talked about that before. And 160D, probably as a concession to developers in the real estate lobby, in order to get 160D passed, the stakes are increased by the availability to an applicant to go to court and not wait till the end of the local government functions, except that they still have to come to you first, and by that very permissive statute with respect to awarding attorney's fees. Those are the things I wanted to bring to your attention based on some of those recent legislative changes. Any questions? You understand?
Sure.
Are you quitting?
No.
I think I,
I don't have to pay the attorney fees, right?
The biggest question I have.
You want
to Did you read the fine print?
No, my glasses are only one, not two.
If the person came and got denied.
Person did what now?
They came in, they went to the historic
applied for a COA at a hearing.
Right. And was turned down, and they applied it to us. And their
they
attorney,
appealed it to you.
Or they appealed it to us. And their attorney comes in. Are you representing the town? Or are you representing us as a board?
That's
are
a
you
great,
making an argument?
That's a great question.
Because I'm sure we'll have questions.
That's a great question. And let me get my thoughts together because you reminded me of something else I wanted to tell you, which I'll do first and then I'll come back to your question. Recently, there's been a lot of buzz about that has been generated by the state bar has, like any licensing board, rules that the licensees have to follow. In the state bar case involving attorneys, it's the code of professional responsibility. And like any other licensing board, the state bar will produce, based on various hypothetical or real scenarios, opinions about the rules. So on one side you got the rules, but you always have to read the administrative opinions and interpretations, like case law. There is an opinion that has really complicated things as far as I'm concerned in the world that we deal with. And that's an opinion about the unauthorized practice of law, which, by the way, is a criminal, I believe it's a criminal misdemeanor. It's pretty serious, and the state bar opinion has focused attention on it to the extent that, because even though John probably, Batson probably knew initially at least, because I certainly got to learn it thereafter, even though John Batson knew initially at least more than I did about obtaining a variance, because the town had a town attorney, John, at the variance hearing, was not allowed to open his mouth. It all had to come from me. The best example of what I'm trying to tell you that the state bar opinion focuses on, perhaps you've had experiences in front of you as a board or witnessing other boards. Let's say somebody wants to get a special use permit. They hire an engineer. I'm a developer. AI, can you put together a site plan for me? And you know, we're going to have to go for a special use permit. Can you go ahead and handle all that for me? And I certainly have seen, waiting for my cases to be called in front of a public body, engineers handling planning and development approval application on behalf of their client who's sitting there. The engineer, presents the case and calls the witnesses. I think you all may have experienced that. I certainly have on multiple occasions.
We've had attorneys present cases for that.
Well, attorneys presenting cases is fine.
Okay. That's
what he's saying. The engineer doing it, the state bar feels, is the unauthorized practice
of law. It's not practice of law.
That the only person that can call witnesses and present opinions through direct examination is the attorney.
Okay.
So I wanted to make sure you knew that. Getting back to impartial decision making, one of the things that I have to avoid is advocating, let's take a minimum housing code situation. I was very involved with building and inspections on getting the remedies the town needed under the minimum housing code for dilapidated housing at 205 Alabama. I was very involved in that process. The variance that John and I got, I certainly was involved in that process. I advocated on behalf of the town. In the minimum housing code, I simply assisted the town, but I think it's close enough that if I took an advocacy role, if those matters came to you all, if a matter came to you all that I was advocating on behalf of the town for at the lower level, that'd be a conflict of interest if I advocated for a result at your level. That's not impartial.
You have to take the town side.
If I assisted the town in such a way that when it came to the Board of Adjustment, and I advocated for a particular decision at that level, the Board of Adjustment level.
Be a conflict of interest.
It'd be a conflict, it wouldn't be a conflict of interest. It would be a violation of the due process rights the applicant is entitled to. So what I've always done is, because it's a fine line, you know, when I helped the town on the minimum housing code, was I advocating? Certainly in the variance matter, I was advocating. Either way, I handle that problem by simply being an advisory. Mm-hmm. I play an advisory role at your level. So, if, for example, if somebody gets up that we don't think has standing, and you look at me and say, does he have standing?
You did that at one of our cases with the gentleman over behind the post office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say I can't answer that question. That's for you all to decide.
Exactly.
But you may want to ask him these questions. So as long as I'm not advocating on your level, I'm okay. And I can still take care of you all through that process that we did.
You did that when the landscaper was speaking. He didn't have standing when he was talking about the well.
Right. Yeah.
And then he was trying to act as an expert. And then...
Tell me what I did because I don't remember.
This was a long time ago. But you had said he was up there going on and on and on about the well, and we let him speak for a few minutes. And then finally you interjected because it was kind of carrying on a little bit. And then you referred us to look at standing. And then we took a minute,
reread the little thing that we had on standing, or you just, or no, I think, I'm sorry, and it's been a while, but anyway, you referred us to standing. We agreed that he did not have stand. He was not a qualified expert.
So you turned him off.
So we shut him down and moved on to the next guy, because it was, you know, that hearing drug on for.
And that's a good example of I'll be there, and you'll get what you need from me, but the only thing you get from me is how to
look at the rules
there by yourself.
Right. It's still a committee's decision, not based solely what you tell us.
I'm not going to tell you anything.
You're just going to give us direction where to find it.
Yeah, yeah. For example, if somebody comes in and starts talking about property values, you're going to remember this well enough to have questions. And Chairman, you may want to inquire about what special damages this witness has experienced. Chairman, you may want to inquire whether there's any expert opinion, whether this person intends to call an expert or present an exhibit. So you'll catch on. I mean, at the end of the day, it's all about being impartial. And let me say one other thing, because I didn't cover it. Conflict of interest is, I've dealt with that for 30 years. I've rarely seen a policy that didn't leave me and staff scratching our heads. Well, I'm not trying to pat my own self on the back, but we have a very good ethics provisions in the code under Chapter 12. And recently, during the budget retreat, we took that and expanded it, and it's now a policy adopted by council for anything. Bottom line is, it's thoroughly fleshed out from decision-making boards, advisory boards, all the way down through staff. It defines the parameters in terms of what is a familial interest, right down to step-siblings and half-siblings and grandparents, yada, yada, yada. But in practice, what will happen is, if you've got it, and so you need to look at that before you exercise any functions in a hearing. I'm sure it's somewhere in Chapter 12. Read it and heed it, and either recuse yourself at the hearing, or if somebody, and you'll see this, without saying anything to anybody, you'll see this play out next Wednesday. Someone, either on the board or in the public, can object to Kirk hearing the case because of a perceived conflict of interest. Kirk can respond to that, but but somebody on the board that still has concerns can make a motion to have Kirk recused and excused, and a majority vote will determine whether he hears that or has to recuse or is recused.
I know it's been a while, but I think that's one of our procedures we ask at the beginning of the hearing.
Yeah, and that's a good way to do it.
If anybody has any comments.
But it can also, you know, it can come out of left field. The chairman may ask for anybody in opposition to speak, and you might get it then instead of on the front end. So just, you know, I had a quasi-judicial hearing one time that I played by the book. Everything that I've told you, I did. And the other side paid me the best. I lost that case. Wrongly, I think. But the other side paid me an unintended compliment when they got up and complained to the chairman that Mr. Eldridge is trying to turn this thing into a trial. Well, it is quasi-judicial. It is evidentiary. They are entitled to an impartial decision maker. And we have black and white guidelines about the requirement to carry the burden of competent material and sufficient evidence. And we have black and white guidelines telling us what is competent and what is incompetent evidence. So yeah, it is legal. And that makes it difficult, not so much for you all. You all have done a good job. But I've been in advisory capacity for a lot of boards in several towns. And it's a hard concept for lay quasi-judicial making boards that are lay boards. It's a hard thing for them to grasp. Usually what happens in those cases, I don't know that I did it for you all, don't know that I need to do it for you all, may do it for you all if you handle HPC because that'll be brand new, may do it for you all if we get into other administrative decisions. But I tend to do a decision worksheet that kind of lays out the issues and gives space for what evidence, lays out the issues, gives you an alternative with respect to finding of facts, is not, did not, with spaces to list the identifying evidence below. And sometimes I even facilitate the discussion. But ultimately, you all make the decision. Of course, it's all open session. And you don't need to be perfect, because if you give me what I need to work on, and I'll make sure that you do, I take all that information and produce the written decision, which is a more comprehensive document. But you make the decision by majority or super majority or super majority if it's a variance vote at the hearing after summarizing the evidence, and by consensus, not voting, deciding on the findings of facts and identifying what evidence supports those findings, because that's what the court's going to look at. Well, they did finding number three, but they didn't identify the evidence that supports it. Without that, the court's not going to be able to determine whether you're right or wrong on that finding. So, I could keep going, but that's what I've got to say.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your attention. I'm always accessible if you have questions.
At all hours.
But, you know, certainly. For you, yes.
A motion to adjourn.
Do what, ma'am?
A motion to adjourn.
How about it? Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
Second.
You made a motion, he seconded it.
All in favor.
All right.
All right. You turn it off.